The following message was recorded at the No Regrets Men's Conference. More information about the conference is available at noregretsconference.org. Feel free to make copies of this message for others, but please do not charge for those copies or alter the content in any way without permission.
You've tried and it's not working out. And I also assume some of you here, all of us here, want to know what it means to be forgiven by our Creator. I've talked about a lot of topics over the years, but forgiveness is the one that I think I get the most response on because it is so core to human life. I was just talking to Carl. He said that over all the years that he's been married, I mean, forgiveness is just part and parcel of it. But we have a lot of misunderstandings about forgiveness. Sometimes we make it more complicated than what it needs to be. Sometimes we confuse forgiveness with a thing called forbearance, and there's a big difference between the two. Most of all, my heart's desire is that you'll find this session liberating, because I think that the greatest thing about forgiveness is that in forgiveness we find freedom. Or to put it negatively, if we don't forgive or find forgiveness, we end up in a life of prison. We end up our own prisoners, prisoners to resentment, prisoners to guilt, and a whole lot of other things. So I really think, I know for a fact that what God wants for our lives is a joyous sense of freedom, even though we're going to need to be forgiven our whole lives long, because we're going to make mistakes. We're going to, sorry about the no regrets title, we're going to have regrets. I know what they mean by no regrets, but there is a flip side to it, and that is that regret is what drives us toward seeking forgiveness when we need to be forgiven. Now, I know that the time is going to fly by, and I think that we'll get across some substantive ideas in this, but I always want to leave people with more afterwards. So we have at half price a book called Overcoming Guilt and Shame that I wrote with a psychologist friend, half price, $5 in the box on the way out, and a Easter devotional and something about the Bible too. There were two brothers who hated each other. They hated each other's guts. They hated each other for good reason, because they had done wrong to each other. They were very different from each other in temperament. One was very wild, man of the outdoors. The other was very cultured. And they were both kind of trying to cut corners in life. One cheated the other out of his inheritance. And over a period of many years, that resentment turned into deep bitterness. I'm talking about a guy named Esau and a guy named Jacob in the Old Testament. They were brothers. And in the book of Genesis in chapter 33, we read about their reunion after many years of being estranged from each other. Jacob now has children, and he has herds, and he's got belongings. He hasn't seen his brother in years, and when he last left him, he had left cheating him out of his inheritance. What we read in the book of Genesis is that as Jacob and his whole entourage approaches Esau and his 400-man militia, Jacob was filled with fear. But Esau met him with a gift called forgiveness. And Jacob bowed 7 times down to the ground before his brother Esau and offered him many riches, many gifts. And Esau said, I don't need you to give me anything. I'm glad to see your face. I'm just glad to see your face because it's like seeing the face of God. That's actually what Jacob said to Esau when Esau came to him with a heart of forgiveness. So 3 points this morning: what forgiveness is, secondly, how forgiveness works, and thirdly, some complications about forgiveness. What forgiveness is, how forgiveness works, and some complications about forgiveness. For instance, can you forgive somebody who hasn't asked for forgiveness? That's a complication. Can you forgive somebody who keeps making the same mistake over and over again? Can you ask for forgiveness because you know that you've made the same mistake over and over again? Forgiveness at one level is very simple, at another level is very complicated. What is forgiveness, though? First of all, forgiveness is not just avoiding conflict. I mean, some people love conflict. I think a lot of people are conflict. They have an aversion to conflict. They will avoid conflict at any cost. And some people think that they're being forgiven if they just avoid other people. Well, that's not what forgiveness is. It says sometimes we need to confront issues head on. Secondly, forgiveness is not compromising your standards or your morality. If you forgive somebody who did something wrong to you, you're not saying that it doesn't matter that they did something wrong. A wrong is a wrong. A sin is a sin. A transgression is a transgression. Theft is theft. If you forgive somebody something that they have done wrong, that is not redefining what they did. Because if nothing else in life, we always need moral clarity. And thirdly, forgiveness is not a violation of justice. If you choose to forgive somebody or somebody forgives you, it is not that in the cosmos there is some conflict and justice has been ill-served. Forgiveness happens even though we retain our standards, even though there is justice. And one of the most powerful examples of this last year was that shooting in South Carolina, where this young man came into a Bible study, and before they know it, after an hour of sitting with these people, he's killing people with his handgun. And the people in that church in South Carolina, within days said that they were forgiving that young man. Now, to some people that made no sense whatsoever because it looked like a violation of justice. It looked like saying it doesn't matter what he did. Of course it mattered what he did. And he is suffering the consequences in the legal system for what he did. So if forgiveness is not that, what is it actually? Here's where it's simple. The New Testament word for forgiveness simply means to let go. It means to release. And that's where I think sometimes we make forgiveness more complicated than what it means to be. It's to let go, to leave, to release, to pardon. It is to say to somebody else, I've been kind of holding you in debt for what you did to me. And it's gone on for a long time. But I'm choosing to release you from being indebted to me. It's not calling something that was wrong right. It is simply saying, I am no longer going to be the judge over you. I am going to release you. Let me give you an illustration. I live just up the road here on Barker Road, just a mile up the road. And so I come back and forth to this building many times. And on a couple of occasions, a police officer has pulled me over to remind me to graciously remind me that the speed limit on this road is a mere 25 miles an hour. Even though I know I can breeze through there a lot faster. It's really embarrassing when it's a Sunday morning and there's all kinds of Elmbrook members going by as I'm having my conversation and they wave at me as they go by. Now, you know the feeling when you see the lights in your rearview mirror, unless you are more virtuous than anybody else in the room. You know, your hands kind of get clammy. Your heart kind of skips a beat. You get pulled over. You think, okay, what could it be? Probably it's a speedometer. And on occasion, that police officer does something. It's the most wonderful thing in the world. It's the greatest gift in the world. It's the best feeling in the world. When he says, I'm just going to give you a warning. And you say, yes, sir, I will take that warning. I will never sin the rest of my life. I will always obey. Well, that's release. That's release. You violated the law. I violated the law. He could write me a ticket. But in that moment, and for particular important reasons, he chooses to release me. Now, that's the simplicity of forgiveness. Given human nature, sometimes we actually want to hold onto resentment. You see, if somebody did something to you and you hold on to them in resentment, you almost feel as though you can hold it over their head. So, given human nature, we may be tempted to hold on to someone else because we know we would rather have people be indebted to us rather than the other way around. We would rather be in control than to be controlled. And we'd really like to be more righteous than the other person. So all of those are reasons why we hold on to debts. But the Bible says forgive each other. Why does it say that? It says in the Gospel of John at the very start that when Jesus Christ came into the world, he came with the glory of God the Father, and he was full of grace and truth. Those two things side by side settle out a lot of matters in life. Grace is mercy, love, forgiveness. Truth is holding on to standards of right and wrong. And somehow those two can work hand in hand. They were in the life of Jesus Christ because he forgave people. He forgave the soldiers who were nailing him to the cross. And yet, on the other hand, Jesus never let anybody get away with anything. There was truth there. He held on to the standards. Now, when I became senior pastor of this church, what I felt inspired to say to the congregation at that moment in time, back in 2000, is my greatest aspiration is for this church to be a place typified by grace and truth. You have to have both. If you have grace without truth, you're just too soft. If you have truth without grace, you're too rigid, you're too hard. And I also thought in my marriage, in my family life, in my character, if somehow I can have both grace and truth, I'll be doing okay. Forgiveness is, in a way, a new way of looking at other people. See, grace says that person did me wrong, but I know that they can be better than that. I know that God views them as having more potential than that. And so it's a new way of looking at others as to what the other person may be. And finally, forgiveness is this. Forgiveness is both a decision and it's a process. It's a decision and it's a process. See, if that cop, when he says, I'm going to give you a warning, he made a decision right there. And he can't revoke it. At least in that moment. So that's the decision. And so when you and I forgive somebody else, you say, you know, I'm going to release this person from being indebted to me. But if they did you wrong, you may feel resentment for a long time to come. A lot of people labor over that. They say, forgive and forget, right? I think I've forgiven. I'm not expecting them to pay me something, to do something for me. I've let them go, but I still feel resentful about what happened. Well, forgive and forget is a good principle, but it isn't like when you forgive somebody, all of a sudden you become amnesiac. You forget what happened. No, of course we remember what happened. God remembers what we did in our past, though he forgives. To forgive and forget means that you release somebody, that's the decision, and then in the process, you let that matter slip into the back of your mind instead of being right here in the front of your mind. You don't forget it entirely, but you say, I'm going to take it off the table, and when I encounter that person, I'm going to try to behave as if that thing never happened. I had a husband and wife come in to talk to me once. I wanted to talk to a pastor because he had violated his marriage vows by sleeping with somebody else on a business trip. It was a one-time thing. It wasn't something that he had premeditated. It just happened. And they were there because this had happened sometime back, a few months earlier, and they knew that it didn't need to blow up their marriage. She had forgiven him. But the issue of the day was she had forgiven, but she hadn't forgotten. I mean, she still felt very wounded by what happened. And so they essentially wanted to talk about forgiveness. And so we talked about forgiveness being a decision. In this case, the husband really was repentant about what he had done. But I asked her, listen, it's been 4 months now or whatever it was. Do you feel less resentful now than you did 2 months ago? She said, yeah. And at that time, did you feel less resentful than right after the incident came to light? She said, yeah. And I said, could it be that your resentment is like a fire that needs to gradually die down? And eventually it will die down. I don't know why, as a kid, I liked playing with fire. I set a lot of things on fire as a kid. If my mom knew everything I set on fire, she would be surprised. But I remember one time being with some buddies, and we're going to make a campfire at night under some pine trees, and we put some open crates on there for kindling. Well, all of a sudden, we're looking at 6 feet of flames here, and I thought, oh, my gosh, we're going to set this whole woods on fire. I was petrified. I was terrified until the moment when the flames that leapt up gradually started to get less. And eventually, it was under control, it was tamed, and I knew that nobody would ever find out about that particular incident. So it is with resentment. Sometimes these things need to run their course. Sometimes they need to burn themselves off. Forgiveness is a decision, but it also is a process. That's the first thing, what forgiveness is. Second thing, how forgiveness works. And by the way, I'm going to try my best to leave some time at the end for questions. So if you have questions along the way, we'll discuss that at the end. How forgiveness works. How does this actually work? Well, two different things. Whether you're seeking forgiveness for yourself or whether you need to forgive somebody else, two entirely different processes. So let's say you're the person who needs to be forgiven. And as I said at the start, I know a lot of you are here because that's where you're at. You messed up, or you've been messing up for a long time. You've asked for forgiveness. You haven't asked for forgiveness again. How in the world does this work? That's one side of the coin. Well, I can't give you a better prescription than Psalm 32, verses 1 through 5. And I'm just going to read these words. Psalm 32, King David, a righteous man, who said this, "Blessed is the person whose transgressions are forgiven, whose sins are covered. Blessed is the person whose sin the Lord does not count against him, and in whose spirit is no deceit." No deceit means you're not playing games with what you have done. Verse 3, "When I kept silent about what I did, my bones wasted away through my groaning all day long. For day and night your hand was heavy on me. My strength was sapped as in the heat of summer." That's the burden of guilt and shame. Of when we know that we've messed up, we know that we've wronged somebody, maybe once, maybe for years. And sometimes we kind of paper over our conscience and we rationalize and we say, well, I did that because somebody else did something. And other times you say, you know, regardless, I shouldn't have done it. I shouldn't have done it. I shouldn't behave that way. I shouldn't relate to somebody else, my spouse or my kids or my friends or my coworkers in that way, and your bones are wasting away. Now, God gave us a conscience as a gift. Conscience is a gift. It's the only way that we keep civilized. If we had no consciences, and some people do, they have a pathological condition in which they have no conscience. Life has lost all meaning. I mean, the guy's cutting off the heads of Christians in the Middle East have hardened their conscience. There's nothing left there. They're behaving as less than human. They're behaving as worse than animals. So God's gift to us is a conscience. Even though it can be troublesome, it can hurt when you feel guilty, when you feel ashamed. Well, that's what King David said. Now, here's the good part. In verse 5, he says, "Then I acknowledged my sin to you, and I didn't cover up my iniquity. I said, I will confess my transgressions to the Lord, and you forgave the guilt of my sin. Period. You forgave the guilt of my sin. And though David wrote this hundreds of years before Jesus hung on a cross, making it possible for human beings to be forgiven, David understood that given the character of the God that he knew, that even though David was responsible for people's deaths, and though David was guilty of adultery, David was guilty of not taking care, David was guilty of almost everything that a man can do, he said, you forgave the guilt of my sin. But that verse 5 is really important. I acknowledged my sin to you. I didn't cover it up. I said, I'll confess my transgressions to the Lord. It's very interesting also in Psalm 51 where David, after his adultery, is confessing to God. It's confession to God first, but it doesn't stop there. If you wrong somebody else and you hope that maybe they might do what God has done for you and forgive you, you have to confess to them. You have to confess to the person that you wronged. There's nothing in the Bible that says that you confess your sin to anybody and everybody. I mean, most conflicts stay between people. You may want to confess to a trusted friend who can guide you and support you and so on, but that's not like confessing to God, and it's not like confessing to the person that you wronged. That's confiding in a good friend who can help you out. But remember what Psalm 32 says, that forgiveness that God is able to give us, and that maybe the person that we wronged might be willing to give to us, maybe not immediately, but that gift is something that cannot be ignored. I know a lot of people who they know that God has forgiven them, but the person that they wronged haven't at all. They may not want to forgive you. They might want to hold it over you. They may want to feel more righteous than you. They may not believe in any of this. There are a lot of people that hear the testimony of Christians saying, I've been forgiven. Charles Colson, who ended up in prison during the Nixon administration, and he talked about finding God. And a lot of people looked at that skeptically and said, that's bogus. You know, either you do right or you do wrong in life. So there's a lot of people who they don't get released by the person that they wronged, but they content themselves in knowing that God has forgiven them. Now, what if you're on the other side of the line? What if you're the person who ought to forgive somebody else? They have confessed to you, and you need to forgive them. This is where we need to distinguish between forgiveness and forbearance. You forgive someone when they sinned against you, when they did something that was morally wrong. It's a serious thing. You forbear minor irritations, and we shouldn't confuse the two. There are many ways, I'm sure, that if my wife were here, she could say, although she's grace enough that she wouldn't say publicly, ways in which my behavior just irritates her a little. Or a lot. Okay, it's just my temperament, it's my patterns, it's my idiosyncrasy. They're not sins, just my temperament or the differences between us. We've been married for quite a few years now. I can't remember how many. But she'll forgive me that I don't remember the exact number of years. So I'm so glad that as a gracious person, she forbears the minor irritating things, and I forbear a few things about her that irritate me. Now, that's a part of life, but let's not confuse that with forgiveness. You don't forgive somebody. You don't have to forgive somebody every time they're 10 minutes late for something. They just may be wired to be a person that they don't read clocks particularly well. They haven't discovered that we have digital clocks in the modern era, and so it's irritating to other people, but that's different from when you have to forgive somebody because they stole something from you, they maligned your reputation to somebody else. I think that is so common, that people are wounded because somebody has been saying things to other people about you that are wrong, that are overly critical, that are condemnatory, that are inaccurate, that are exaggerations, that are fabrications. That's everyday stuff, right? Well, and that's the occasion of needing to forgive other people. I mean, sometimes when we discover that, we need to try to clean it up. I gave up a long time ago figuring I need to run around figuring out what everybody is saying about me behind my back so I can clean up their messes. I've been a pastor of a very big church. I'm still in a very big church. I can't run around and clean up misrepresentations of what other people have said about me. And you know, I'm glad I have the freedom to say, if somebody wants to mischaracterize my motives or who I am or what I said or what I did, if rumor passes something on this untrue, in the end, God's justice is going to prevail, and I don't need to run around cleaning up other people's messes. So, when to forbear, when to forgive. The willingness to forgive is the real question of the day. Am I willing to let this person go? And I can think of instances in my life where somebody did wound me badly. And at that time, I was not ready to let it go. As a matter of fact, I felt as though to let it go would be wrong because somebody needed to deal with some stuff here. This can't just be forgotten. But with the passage of time, you say, you know, I've said what I need to say. And it's not going to do any good to keep repeating it. That person knows how I feel about things. That person knows that they wounded me. Maybe they agree, maybe they don't. I've said my piece. And now it's time for me to let it go. Not to let it go, to let that person go. Knowing that even though I let that person go, I'm not calling something that they did wrong right. The most dramatic moment when I needed to forgive somebody related to my own father. I was 4 years old when my father died at the age of 26. He was 26 years old when he died of sudden pneumonia. So I didn't know him growing up. I have very fuzzy memories as a four-year-old. And I was told all during my grown-up years what a fantastic person he was, a heroic person, almost. By family members who thought that they were doing me a favor by concealing the fact that he was a terrible alcoholic who did a lot of damage to a lot of people. I didn't have a clue till I found out when I was 17 years old. And all of a sudden, when I was 17 years old, my world was turned upside down. The father that I had a relationship with in my imagination became an entirely different person. And I was angry. I was furious. And before long, that anger was eating me up because where was I going to go with it? I couldn't call him on the phone and say, hey, I heard something about you. You have been dead for many years already. And that was when, in my study of the Bible, I discovered that forgiveness means to release. And I realized that my father had to face the judgment of God. All of us face the judgment of God for what we've done, right and wrong. It's not that God is going to cast us away from him if we sin, because sinners are forgiven. But what we did that was wrong is going to be shown for what it is. Justice is going to be revealed for what it is at the end of all things, at the end of our lives. And so I knew that. I knew that I was not the Supreme Court for my father's virtues and his vices. That's God. And so I found wonderfully the ability quite quickly to let it go, to let him go, even though I couldn't have a conversation, and even though he certainly never had an opportunity to ask me to forgive him for things that happened within our family. Being willing to forgive, letting the other person go. So, we're on to the third point. The first point was what forgiveness is. Second point, how forgiveness works. If you're the person needing to confess, that's one side. If you're the person needing to forgive, that's the other side. The third point for this morning is complications with forgiveness. First of all, there can be some roadblocks. If our hearts have turned really, really bitter and resentful, or somebody who we hope would forgive us, even though we've confessed, they're bitter. The human heart can become fixed in a state of resentment, bitterness, vindictiveness, malice, and that's a complication to forgiveness when somebody's heart has really become hard. If you know that you need to forgive somebody else, but you are really, really bitter, you are deeply, deeply resentful, you're going to have to pray for God to soften your heart. Nothing bad is going to happen if God does that. But bitterness and resentment and vindictiveness and malice, it's going to be a roadblock. And you're going to be a prisoner to yourself. Your resentment is going to hold you into a jail. If the person who you're hoping would forgive you is bitter and resentful and vindictive, well, that's a complication also. And all that you can do is say the right thing to them. If you wronged them, admit it. What you can't do is demand that they forgive you. You can't ever say to somebody else, you know, the Bible says forgive 70 times 7, and I'm only up to 35. So I've asked for your forgiveness. You forgive me right now. You can't say that. You can hope for that. But if you demand somebody to forgive you for something that you've done wrong, you're going to undermine the whole process. I've talked to many people in this situation, too, where they so want to have reconciliation. They've said the right thing. They've confessed what they did wrong. And the other person is bitter. They're resentful. And there just doesn't appear to be a crack in that. You're just going to have to live with that. You're just going to have to live with it. But I will also tell you of the many, many situations where with the passage of time, finally the person that you have asked forgiveness for, something happens in their life and their hard heart begins to open up. So that's one complication. Another complication to forgiveness is if the person you need to forgive is dead. I mean, I couldn't go very far with my resentment toward my father, but I discovered that I could. Because the fullest form of forgiveness is two-way. He asked me for forgiveness because he knew that he wronged me, and I say, thank you so much for saying that. I've been waiting for you to say that for a long time. I let you go. That's the best. That's what I call bilateral forgiveness. But let's say that person is here, is not here. Let's say that person has no interest. I can still forgive, even though it's unilateral. Even though it's unilateral, I say, I let you go. After all, God needed to do that. In Christ, God was forgiving the world even before the process of bilateral reconciliation was happening. Another complication to forgiveness is when the person who's done something wrong is doing it habitually. That's tough. It's really tough. Let's say a person's got a real problem with anger or violence, and it's happened again and again and again, and they apologize and they apologize and they apologize, and they were forgiven once, and they were forgiven twice, and they were forgiven a third time, but now you're up to 12 times. Now you're up to 15 times. If it's a serious and deeply hurtful sin or dynamic, it's really pretty complicated to expect somebody to forgive you when they've got every reason to believe that tomorrow you may do the same thing again. Same thing with substance abuse or alcoholism. I mean, people who wrestle with substance abuse, they'll ask for forgiveness again and again. And yes, getting past those patterns can be a process, and there are relapses and so on, and you come back to asking for forgiveness again. And that's just part of the process. But when the person keeps repeating the same thing with no intention whatsoever of stopping the behavior, that's pretty much a showstopper as far as forgiveness is concerned. Are there roadblocks to forgiveness? Are there limits to forgiveness? Well, somebody said to Jesus one day, how often should I forgive my brother? Seven times? And that shows how we'd like to know what the limit is. I mean, seven times is a lot to forgive somebody. Don't tell me it's eight. Don't tell me it's 10. And Jesus said, no, let's try 70 times seven. And he didn't even mean 49 times, literally. What Jesus meant is that, hey, you may need to forgive your brother, your friend, your co-worker, or your spouse many times over. They do undermine forgiveness, though, if they unthinkingly are just repeating the same injury again and again. Another limit to forgiveness is when the person who did wrong hasn't admitted to it. I get back to that question. Can you forgive somebody who they don't think they did anything wrong? They don't think it at all. You told them that they did wrong. You told them that you were deeply injured, but they don't buy it. They don't agree with it. That definitely limits reconciliation or bilateral forgiveness. It doesn't have to limit unilateral forgiveness, where you say to yourself and to God, you know, that person, they don't see it. They don't think they did a blame thing wrong. But I'm not going to waste any of my energy or any of my time holding on to them, indebted to me, resentful toward them. I'm letting them go. And I'm not going to interact with them more than what I absolutely have. Another thing, and we're almost done, and then we'll have time, a little bit of time for question and answer if you want to. There are limits to forgiveness. You can't forgive somebody for what they did to somebody else. You can't forgive somebody for what they did to somebody else. If you have somebody that you work with or a family member who is abusing or hurting or wronging or stealing from somebody else, you can say, I'm going to be the big-hearted Christian person here. I'm going to forgive them. The person who's being injured said, what in the world are you thinking? It's not up to you to forgive that person because they didn't wrong you. They wronged me. Now, that would almost seem to go without saying, and yet this is how confused things can get. I'll never forget many years ago when the President of the United States needed to admit to the whole country that a inappropriate physical sexual liaisons that he was having with a young intern that he denied for a long time, now he admitted. He went on television speaking to the whole country, asking for forgiveness. And I remember thinking, first of all, this is really, really disappointing. I mean, how in the world did we get here? But I also remember thinking, you know, it's not up to me to forgive the president. I can be disappointed. I can feel as though the country was put in danger. But really what I am most interested in is what's happening behind closed doors between the principals of who actually wronged who. So let's not get that confused. We have enough on our hands in terms of forgiving people done wrong to us or us asking forgiveness for people that that we have disappointed. So let me come back to one last point. Remember at the start I talked about the two brothers who hated each other. And Jacob approached Esau and his militia of 400 men and thought, they're just going to slaughter me. Esau is going to enact his revenge on me. I want to read a quote by David Augsburger about the concept of revenge. He said, "Revenge is the most worthless weapon in the world. It ruins the avenger while more firmly confirming the enemy in his wrong. It initiates an endless flight down a bottomless stairway of rancor, reprisals, and ruthless retaliation." That's why revenge is never the order of the day. Let me leave you with this. At the end of Jacob's life, when he was an old man, and he saw his 12 sons engaged in a bitter conflict with each other, Joseph, who became a mighty ruler in Egypt, had been, his other brothers were jealous of him. They left him to be sold into slavery. They left him for dead. They lied about it. Well, the end of the story is Joseph and his 11 brothers get back together, and Jacob, the patriarch of the father, the old man at the end of his life, said this. "This is what you are to say to Joseph. I ask you to forgive your brothers the sins and the wrongs they committed in treating you so badly. Now please forgive the sins of the servants of the God of your father." And when Joseph heard this, he wept. Jacob, at the end of his life, says of his sons who were in a terrible, terrible conflict, "You guys got to work this out, and you got to forgive, because there was a day when I met my brother face to face, and instead of reenacting revenge against me, he let me go." So, whatever your situation, seek God's face. Remember, we'll have time here for about 7-8 minutes of questions. There's a lot more overcoming guilt and shame. There's also back there an Easter devotional for the 3 weeks leading up to Easter, and also one on how to understand the Bible, because this is what has the liberating word for us. Questions that you may have. Yes, sir. Thank you. And I'm going to repeat the question for the tape. What about forgiving yourself? I'm sorry. Yes. What about forgiving yourself? Thank you for mentioning that. I should not have neglected saying that. There is part of the process of forgiveness where maybe you're holding yourself in debt to yourself, which is a weird kind of thing. But if you say, "I believe that on the basis of the truth of God's word, he has forgiven me," then I can't live my life cowering in guilt and shame. I need to let myself go. Now, sometimes a person can flip that switch themselves. Oftentimes you need to talk to somebody else so that you can say, "You know, maybe I'm not letting myself go because I didn't really do this right. I really am still guilty in this situation." And a trusted confidant can say, "No, based upon what you're telling me, you've done the right thing. Now you need to accept God's forgiveness." Another question? Yes. You have forgiven them?
Yeah.
And they're, well, that's a confused situation. They would be telling you that because, like he was saying, that you're not forgiving yourself?
No.
Oh.
They've done stuff.
Yeah.
And you have forgiven them for it.
Yes.
But they turn around and say, "You're the one that needs to forgive yourself."
All right.
Oh,
okay. Well, that is often the case. I mean, it would be great when people wrong other people that you can sit down, you can put the cards out on the table, and you can each admit where you were wrong. And by the way, in most of our conflicts, both sides have some degree, both sides did something. Although it certainly can be like the husband and wife I was talking about, you know, she didn't do anything wrong because he had a fling with somebody on a business trip. But oftentimes people can't see eye to eye. They are confused about who did wrong. Maybe they don't, maybe they're confused today, but 6 months from now, they do get some clarity. Another question? Sure. Yeah. And I had real mixed feelings about that because I thought, that wasn't the smartest thing to do, but I understood why they did it. I was 4 years old, and they were just trying to protect me. Yes. Yeah. Wow. Nick has pointed out that social media makes all of this complicated. When people can just in a knee-jerk way post something on Facebook, and they do it to get at you. I mean, I'll give you an example of this. There was a woman who went to a restaurant, and she saw her husband sitting there with another woman when he was supposed to be at work. She took a picture of it. She posted it to Facebook. And she said, look what my husband is doing right now. Wow. You know, and all of her friends on social media, you know, what do you do with that? Well, it was a little bit like just, you know, making it public. I think we need to be very, very careful and disciplined about what we post in social media. And realize that if ever you feel something hot inside, like I'm just gonna give a little zinger. Maybe it'll be subtle. Well, what we think is subtle probably isn't all that subtle. Don't do it. Just don't do it. Or write it out. Same thing with email too. Have you ever sent an email to somebody and 10 minutes after you sent it, you said, you know, I should have counted to 10 before I hit the send button. Another thing that is happening these days is people writing hot emails about their anger about somebody else, and then they inadvertently send it to the person that they're writing about. That's happened to me twice, where somebody was upset with me, they wrote about me, instead of sending it to their friend, they sent it to me. Well, I love hitting the return button and saying, I'm not sure you intended this to come to me. And then just wait to see what happens next. Really need to be careful. I think that email and social media, it gives us a sense of release. And that's why there's so much garbage out there, too. I love social media. But, boy, we need to keep it careful. Yes, way in the back. You mean when somebody wrongs somebody else and there are other people as collateral damage that get hurt? Wow. Well, when we're in that spot, when we wrong somebody else, and it's not just that one person was hurt, but there were consequences with others, and this is so hard, we may need to swallow hard and ask for forgiveness, not just of that one person, but the other people who were involved. I am a big believer, by the way, sometimes in writing a letter of apology. I know that some would say, you know, it's far better to sit down with somebody face to face. But sometimes it's not very possible to do that. I think that if you, not email, this is a case where snail mail is best. If you write down your feelings and your regrets and you send it to that person, and you're open-minded about having a face-to-face conversation, but you want to get this off of your shoulders. You want to say to somebody, I did wrong, and I feel terrible about it. I think that's very appropriate. It's better than silence. And regarding collateral damage, that is also a way that you could with some degree of precision and control. That's what I also like about writing, is I can be very precise about what I say. That's where maybe if there are four other people involved, you can write something to them and say, by the way, you didn't need to see that. You didn't need to be a part about that. I feel terrible about it. I'm trying to make amends. So, yeah, it's hard. The thing that I don't believe in is if I wrong this person and we had something going on, that I would feel as though I need to confess it in front of everybody. There are some people that think that's what the Christian gospel demands. The Christian gospel never says that. Yes, right here. We have 2 minutes left, and then... A person may be, they may be inspired to do something that is extraordinary, though it may not be the typical case. Let me mention one other thing not to do, is to confess to somebody else something that you have done that will hurt them only more. It is never, ever appropriate to go to an attractive young woman in the place that you work and say, I've got to confess something to you. I have been watching you like a hawk. I have been lusting after you. And I feel terrible about it, and I'm dealing with God. Okay, we laugh nervously, and that is something you deal with God. You don't always confess to that person. It's 11:05. You got ample time. Have a great day.